answered. The pilot would say that he was focused on survival, getting his plane repaired, getting water, getting away. But it is also true that the pilot's questions of the prince go unanswered. Mostly that is because the pilot is a practical man, and the questions he asks are frankly unanswerable in the context of the little prince's life. A breakthrough in their communication occurs when the pilot realizes that the prince is from a tiny asteroid, not this Earth or even a full planet, that everything that the prince has known is in this tiny little space. And at about the same time, the pilot begins to realize that the way that grown-ups talk to one another can have a problem. The pilot at one point speaks to us, because this memoir of his interactions with the little prince is written many years later, at a time he's had so much opportunity to mull things over. He says to us, the readers, "If I have told you these details about the asteroid and made note of its number for you, it is on account of the grown-ups and their ways. When you tell them that you have made a new friend, they never ask you any questions about essential matters. They never say to you, 'What does his voice sound like? What games does he love best? Does he collect butterflies?' Instead, they demand, 'How old is he? How many brothers has he? How much does he weigh? How much money does his father make?' Only from these figures do they think they have learned anything about him." Can we, in our communication with one another, get past asking and getting answers to questions such as, "How much money does his father make and how many brothers does he have?" and move to ask and answer the much more important question of, "What games does he love best? Does he delight in butterflies?" Or others, such as, "What brings you fully alive?" Or, "What has your life's journey been?" Or, "Do you love people who have died in war?" Here is another story about people getting to know one another, though through curiosity and questions. One of our number here told me about a colleague who was different. They worked for a very high-performance company, and one man, we'll call him Dave, was brilliant above the rest. In a meeting, if you could get him to come to the meeting, he was inventive and often offered the creative solution to a problem that others couldn't crack. But then he wouldn't deliver the promised memo explaining his ingenious approach to the problem. He wouldn't show up at the follow-up meeting, and he was often thought of as, frankly, a problem employee. Someone had to talk with him. That was what upper management thought. He needed a talking to. But actually, he needed to be listened to, not talked to. Artful and skillful questions brought out the truth. Dave had problems reading, and even worse, problems writing. Showing up at meetings was a challenge because he couldn't read his own writing about where and when the next meeting would be held. But it was solvable. Dave was privately given some tutoring, he mastered the skills needed, and that difficult employee turned into a star. A leader among his cohort, his brilliance shone out. But what if the person sent to talk to him had indeed talked to him instead of listened? I wonder how the actual conversation, as painful, honest, and ultimately loving as it must have been, went. What was the question that broke through to the truth? I don't know, but I'd love to know. Joan Johnson suggested this sermon topic when she purchased it at the auction last year, and I'm going to weave in some of her thoughts and musings here. What if Dave's manager had a bias against the type of person she saw Dave as? What if that bias was because of race or religion or body shape or gender identity? We have biases, and some of those biases kept us safe as cave people. Greeting a stranger traveling through your land as a friend might not have worked back when light came from fires and safety came from clubs or spears. Back then, safety may have come from avoiding the new, as danger lay with the unknown, and fighting or freezing or fleeing were the wisest path. But not now. Let me tell you another story. This story is also true, and it is about one of my ministerial colleagues, and always makes me cry. The minister was a tiny woman and was quite old at the time of this story. In fact, she's now died. She lived in a major city, let us say New York, and she relied on public transportation. Neither she nor her neighbors had a car or money for a taxi. On the night in question, she was out late doing a hospital visit. Perhaps the congregant that she was accompanying had even died that night. She came home by subway and got out at her stop. She quickly noticed that a young man was following her. She, with her sore and tired and old legs, would never outrun him. Instead, she turned and greeted him. She said, and this I quote, "Oh, it's you. I am so glad. I was worried about being alone before you came. But now I am not worried. Now I'm not worried or alone," she said. They walked together to her house. Perhaps he even carried her bags. And they sat on the front stoop. They talked till dawn, and the boy, whose intentions were not that kind when first they met up, was transformed. After a night of gentle questions and conversations, he went his own way, and she went to bed. I don't know if they ever saw one another again, but they saw one another that night. What started that beautiful chain of events? You could say that it started with her welcoming him, greeting him as a friend. But actually, I think that it started before that. I think that it started with the minister's spiritual practices of openness and curiosity, of open-hearted welcome, not assuming, not projecting, not closing down, just being open. Now, we all know that this could have gone differently. She might have ignored him. They could have passed in the night. He could have tried to rob her or hurt her. Other outcomes are possible. But something in her spirit turned this event on a dime and created an outcome I think of often, the outcome of connection and love. It does not seem like an easy situation, but maybe it is easier than some. The one I'm thinking about now is the one where someone you know, sort of know, or know very well, says something that sets off a trigger for you, where what they said offends you. Maybe it seems biased or at the least thoughtless. What then? What can we do then? Was there a chance you didn't hear it right? Or that language was a barrier instead of a bridge? And what about the other person? Maybe they know or fear that they said something hurtful. In fact, some of us learn not to question and instead believe what we are doing something wrong and deserve to be criticized. Maybe the person's intent wasn't to be mean at all. What then? Maybe it's time to be curious about what was meant rather than assuming it was an attack. Being curious can lead us to stronger relations and connections with others, which is where real spiritual growth is possible. So it is time for honest questions, for vulnerable curiosity, for powerful questions, for questions that open a door. Maybe the question is just, I'm curious what you mean when you say that. Maybe you could say, could you say more? Forrest Church, who is one of the luminaries theologically of our denomination, reminds us that the answer you get depends on the question you ask. Begin by looking for new questions, not old answers. Answers close doors, questions open them. Answers lock us in place, questions lead us on adventures. I'm reminded of a situation a friend just told me about. She said that she and a colleague she liked and wanted to work with had a disagreement. It doesn't really matter what the disagreement was about, but the one whose feelings were hurt went to the other to discuss it. They talked, and things were officially fine. And the one who brought it up thought that they would just go their separate ways to meet whenever their paths crossed next. Perhaps not with as much warmth as before the whole thing had started. Instead, the other one, the one who had just been questioned hard about her past actions, stopped and said, "Stop. How are you? What's up for you?" That question was the revolutionary act. She reached out with a question to normalize the situation and got them past the just wrapped up tension. My friend said that they are getting along well now. They have created bonds and intimacy. It took both that initial sorted out conversation and the subsequent normalization of asking a conversation starting question to get them to the good place that they are in now. And then there are questions that can change someone. John Woolman was a Quaker who lived in the 1750s. His goal was to abolish the practice of slavery among American Quakers. Yeah, 100 years before the Civil War. For 30 years, he visited and challenged his wealthy conservative contemporaries who used slave labor. Nearly a century before the Civil War, the Quakers released their slaves, in large measure following his work. Greenleaf notes that Woolman's approach did not include scolding or shaming. Rather, he raised questions. What does the owning of slaves do to you as a moral person? What kind of institutions are you giving to your children? Questions are powerful interventions. They invite more light in, they subvert individual mindsets or groupthink, they challenge. If we choose to be comforters, appeasers, or know-it-all advisors, we are not on the side of health. Ironically, discomfort is the very challenge that can stimulate conversations and thus growth. Discomfort, curiosity, and growth go together. In a non-threatening, anxiety-less environment, we cannot learn how to respond, nor can we grow. Focus on challenge, loving challenge, not comfort. Joseph M. Cherry has written this prayer for living in tension. If we have any hope of transforming the world and changing ourselves, we must be bold enough to step into our discomfort, brave enough to be clumsy there, loving enough to forgive ourselves and others. May we, as a people of faith, be granted the strength to be so bold, so brave, and so loving. Blessed be. Ashe. Amen.